Hey, what's happening? Welcome to the Everyday Bowhunter, Episode 4. I'm Mike. Dan and I this week are going to dig into a bunch of listener questions. We're going to talk about deer bedding. We're going to talk about how to hunt the wind and how we pick our spots for hunting this upcoming season. And we're going to dig into some interesting stories that Dan's got that's going to make you laugh your ass off. So come on with me. Let's start the episode and let's get ready to rock. Welcome to the Everyday Bowhunter. I'm your host, Mike Manley, retired Green Beret turned bowhunter, joined by my brother, Dan Ziemer. We're here to share tips, stories, and talk gear, all from our unique points of view. Whether you're just starting out or you're a seasoned bowhunter, I think you're going to like it. So let's go. All right, Dan, episode 4. I can't believe we're in the fourth episode already. Rock and roll.
Heck yeah, it's been fun already.
Yeah. I think we might actually do a good podcast this time. Just kidding. We will see. I can't guarantee anything, but I think this is going to be a good one. So this weekend, it's kind of a heavy hunting weekend for both of us.
Yeah, it was a hack weekend for me. I mean, I put a lot of hours in at work, so I decided I'm going to take a vacation day on Friday and get up and go. I was going to go scouting on Saturday, but I got a call from her cousin. Hey, do you want to go crabbing Saturday? Couldn't turn him down. Let's do it. You know, so took a vacation day on Friday. Me and Dad went up scouting. My whole process was I wanted to find a new spot. So just like you know the area that I'm talking about. We coming back from a morning hunt, we always see these deer crossing in this certain spot. And I was like, you know, where are they coming from? And we know what time. And I kind of went in with an open mind and man, I found a honey hole. This is awesome. I mean, really fresh stuff. A lot of rubs from the past season. They still kind of look fresh, you know. What do you call them? History rubs.
Historical. Yeah.
Historical rubs. So kind of used the creek to see where they were crossing the creek and went up from there. And I mean, it was like the local pub up there. It was a gathering spot. And I thought to myself, my goodness, if I could kind of hunt scout that spot, I'm going to be in it this year.
That area there is it's so rocky in there. They're like billy goats going up through there.
Actually, where we were at, it was very fern. It was like
closer, farther down the road there then.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, man, crabbing on Saturday, you couldn't beat the weather. That sunrise coming up over the water, it was so freaking beautiful. And we were catching 8-9 point to point. I mean, jumbos. So we only got 3/4 of a bushel, but when you only get 3/4 of a bushel of jumbos, it's like a bushel. You know what I mean? Oh, it was awesome. I'm making crab soup right now as we speak.
So where at down in the Chesapeake do you guys go?
Oh,
generally.
Yeah, generally. Most of the time we go kind of on the western shore, and this time we went to the eastern shore. He kind of, I guess, figured out a new area, so to speak, and it was on. We were using razor clams as bait instead of chicken necks, because apparently on this river they don't bite on chicken necks, but man, beautiful.
Yeah. You know, when you get all those little ones and you're cracking them and you're barely getting any meat out of them, you're like have to eat 20 to get a meal out of it. You know, it's so frustrating sometimes.
I ate 6 and was full. What's that tell you? That's rare for Maryland blue crab, you know?
Well, I went up Saturday. Oh, actually I went up Friday night to camp and we went to to the winery and stuff and had a wedding singer type band and had a good time, but didn't get up quite as early as I wanted to because of the winery, but got that out happens. And my number one goal was to go out and I had a cell camera, of course, far out that the batteries died on me. I didn't know what the problem was, but it was the batteries. And I got I got up in there. It was a beautiful day, really. I mean, I think it was like 85 degrees, but the humidity's way down. It's great. I mean, I barely walked in the woods and I hit a huge chunk of deer scat that was real chunky. It was either, you know, either a buck or a big doe, and that's eating pretty good. And I hit pile after pile right in there. I was like, wow. And just ran the trail that I had basically been following as I'm patterning that area, and went up in there. And I couldn't find my camera at first. I blew right past it. I went down the mountain a little bit further, and I'm up on that top bench, and I'm coming back towards where my camera actually was when I found it. And I just got hit like a brick. I was like in the freaking deer bedroom, and all I smelled was that musk smell. It was musk, like either yeah. that, or it was almost like one of them had just, you know, pissed right before I got there and then headed out. And it was just so, I was like, whoa, that was pretty cool. I got done that, fixed my camera. I got back to camp and I said, I'm going to shoot in my Iron Will single bevel broadheads that I was so happy to have. And, you know, with my right helical ZMR arrows, and of course, man, me and my, I'm so dumb. I didn't pay attention. I bought them fast and I didn't read the fine print. We have 4mm arrows, you know, they're 0.166 inch.
So your thread was off.
Threads off. So if we had, you know, it's like the 5mm or whatever, or the 204s, then maybe it would have fit, but I needed the deep ones. They're called the deep six yeah. or whatever one. So I'm going to be selling some broadheads. Anybody interested? I got some broadheads for sale that fit regular arrows.
I can't help you out because I shoot the same arrows.
So anyway, I had the tooth of the arrow broadheads that I had from last year, and I had the Magnus Black Hornets.
Right.
So I decided to kind of do a comparison between the two, and I shot, you know, 0 to minute 20, made sure they were flying good, and both of them flew like the field points. I did not have to make any adjustments to my sights at all, which is a miracle in itself. Yeah. And then I put the target at 12 yards, 17 yards, 24 yards, and shot all those bracketing because I used that single pin bracket technique. Yeah. And I was drilling it. But I think the thing that really helped me out, and I told you this the other day, is I put that 12-inch stabilizer on.
Yeah.
And it really evened me out. And I'm shooting so much better than I was. I'm really happy about that. But anyway, I ended up shooting about 60 arrows, and I'm probably going to use the Magnus Black Hornets and see how they rock. And then if I get a doe, I might change up and just see the difference. See if there's any kind of comparison. Right. But anywho, I did that, went back out, scouted some more. I found another spot. But the key thing I found was I found some acorns, fresh acorns falling down, and I found kind of a thermal hub where it just, the hillsides are really big, and the trails that they're taking are just going right along that inside edge, I should say, of that steep ground. And I mean, that's pure billy goat stuff. And I'm like, this is pretty good. And as I told you, there's some places where the trail went under some trees and stuff.
Yeah. And they're cutting tunnels in. Yeah.
Yeah. And the first thing I look for is if anything's tearing up the leaves or the branches above, if they're scraping up, and even with that velvet on, they're poking holes in the leaves above them right around rack width. So I'm fairly confident something's in there, but I hung a camera,
yeah.
a solar camera in that area to see what comes out of it. I also hit some bunch of bear sign in there too. And some more of those bent over trees.
Speaking of the bear, had a friend text me and go, so bears don't like China from the last episode. I just laughed. I was like, oh, you definitely watched the episode then.
I don't know what it is. Bears don't like the Chinese. I told it. Just even since we did that, the bear's back at my camera again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you were sending pictures. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's a big bear.
Hey, before you go, we go into this next section. You had said that somebody had wrote in with some questions, a listener, and would you like to cover that and maybe answer some of this guy's questions or whatever?
Yeah, let's do it. I think it's good. It's kind of aligned with all the preseason prep anyway, and it kind of digs deeper into some of the subjects we talked about and gives more detail about how we do things. And that's really good questions, things that I think we kind of glossed over maybe, and we kind of can go deeper into.
All right, roger that.
So the first question is, what is the number one thing you look for in early season scouting?
Okay, me personally, I have my spots. I don't really, early season, I'm kind of looking for new spots. So the first thing I'm going to do is we go down the road and we look for what's called a slide. So you're going to see that high traffic area. And, you know, generally that's a lot of doe doing that. Your single buck path is not a slide, you know, but we're going to look for that slide. You're going to follow that up in, see where it takes you. You know, sometimes it's very promising. Sometimes you hit a dead end. That happens a lot too, but you also want to go to the opposite side of the road and see if it's consistent, you know, if it's true. But a lot of times, man, you're going to look for that muddy spot that's fresh. You're going to see slides from past years, historical slides, you know, but you're going to look for that fresher stuff, especially right after a rain. You're going to get your best results. I mean, I went up Friday. Thursday, they got dumped on up air camp. I mean, it was buckets of rain. So it showed us, me and
it
Dad.
It rained again on Friday too, didn't it? Didn't it rain up there when you guys were up there? It didn't rain at all when you were up there?
No, not when we were there.
Okay.
Maybe later in the day, but we were.
No, but I agree with you. The rain helped me out a lot. I followed a lot of tracks. There's a ton of tracks in there.
So you're going to, like for me, I'm going to use, back to that historical word, you're going to bank stuff throughout a season, and you're going to see deer crossing in a certain area that you're going to go, I'm going to bank that one. I'm going to think of that later. And hey, man, spring, summer, that's the time to go investigate that. You know, is there a slide, a fresh slide near where you're seeing this activity? And, you know, we did. Followed it, and it was awesome.
So on that point, one place where I talked about in a previous podcast where I had that big racker cross the road in front of me and the DNCR guys.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Right. Let the old man, if you're listening to this, I'm going to hunt up on that hill when you're hunting down below, and I'm going to kill that buck, and I'm going to laugh the whole way down the mountain.
Do it. Like little Ben Stiller, do it. Oh.
Yeah. That's definitely not happening, but I can hope.
You know how good of a hunter he is.
Yeah. Never gonna count him out. Especially with all those notches on his bow.
Yeah.
So I'm very similar. I mean, I've done that for years. You know, the slide thing, we've used that to find some really good spots.
Yeah.
Especially right after a rain, like you said, you can really see which ones are fresh. Even the leaves, you can see when they're turned over as you're walking through, what's fresh tracks and what's not. And it really can give you a direction of movement and stuff. So I was definitely checking that out on Saturday. The things though I think about and I was really concerned with is because the old man said that he saw acorns dropping on the road.
Yeah.
So number one thing in early season, I'm trying to find where is the primary food source that they're hitting on. And if acorns are all kind of sporadic, they could be all over the place in the mountains. It's different than when, you know, the fields down from us have standing corn.
Yeah.
You know, I can see them being down that way a lot. We saw two big bucks out spotting Friday night. So there's some big ones in there.
You sent some nice pictures of them. They look good. I mean, biggest thing, I guess, with online, you're looking for that food source. So on that trail, are there white oaks? That's where your acorns are. And, you know, you kind of follow that.
And I actually went going up to that spot where my cell camera was at. I had my binos out and I'm looking up in the trees. I'm looking in the ground. I didn't see an acorn. So I'm thinking they have to be going somewhere. They're not just going to feed on browse and be happy with it. You know, they got to go somewhere. So that's making me, I want to do a little bit more scouting, maybe some, like you said, scout the hunts, some active scouting to during the season to find those food sources. Cause you can't, it just takes so much time to cover all that territory around there. But anyway, food, you know, I mean the four places you always look for deer, food, water, bedding, and the travel routes, that they're taking. So they have to get there somehow. They're gonna feed overnight. They're gonna hit the water, and they're gonna go to bed, right?
Yeah.
And in that bedding area, they're gonna get up around, and they're gonna have an area where they can feed a little bit during the day. They're not gonna stay down the whole day.
Right.
So that's what I look for. I try to find the bedding areas, and then try to find a spot that's relatively close, and go from there.
Yeah. So is there another question at all?
Put me on the spot, Dan.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Sorry. Well, here, that actually goes into what I just talked about. The next question is, you keep talking about deer bedding. What determines where buck bed where you hunt? And go to you, Dan. What do you think?
I don't know. No, well, I'm just kidding. Well, like for me, buck bedding is they're going to be like, if you, like where I was talking about that congregation area, you know, the does are all going to be bedding in that thick stuff. So the buck to me are going to be higher up on that 2/3 overlooking all that. So you need to get past out around all that doe bedding and that thick stuff and find your elevated upper 2/3 and look for the single bed. That's, you know, if you see a bunch of beds, generally, I mean, it could be a bachelor group, but for the most part, you're looking for that single
early season
bed that's on that.
Like right now, you would see that.
Correct. Yes.
And I did. I think there was multiple beds where I told you I smelled that musk smell.
That's a key part of it too. Yeah.
Yeah. There were multiple beds in there. So I call it the four S's of buck bedding, right? I just made this stuff up. So first off, scent. And that includes your wind and thermals, right? Position themselves where this doesn't go with every single spot or every single deer for that matter, because they have different personalities. But the perfect situation in the mountains where we hunt is where a mature buck that's been around a little while, he's going to be in a position where that wind's coming over his head so he can smell everything behind him. And the thermals are coming up to him from below as the sun rises and goes into that heat of the day. Those thermals rise up and he's going to smell everything in front of him, everything behind him. So that's scent. Next is security. He has to have good security cover. So a lot of them will be in front of like a brush pile, some fallen logs, whatever. You know, or deep in some of them really bed in that deep, thick stuff, especially like near your clear cuts and stuff.
Yeah.
So you have your scent, you have your security, sight. They want to be able to see what's coming at them too. They've got a good overview. I was listening to one podcast. The guy was saying that they had this monster buck that literally sat over the parking area where he could see the parking area. You couldn't see him. You had to go deep into it. But he
smart old buck. Yeah.
When they found him, when they finally killed him, they found where his bed was, and it was overlooking the parking area. So every time somebody went near him, he was out of there. But most people walked past him and never even went up to where he was.
Yeah.
And so sense, security, sight, and sound. So they also, hearing you. So Zach Fehrenbaugh for the Hunting Public always talks about when he's going into a spot, he talks about the fact that, you know, alter your steps. When you get close to where you're going to hunt, or if you know you're passing an area where it might be a travel route, don't just walk like a person, because that is a signal to the deer.
It's like a cadence.
They'll be out of there. They'll be gone. So instead, you alter your cadence, you know, walk a few steps, stop, walk a little bit more, but try to be as quiet going into your spot or whatever. But yeah, I think that's pretty good analysis. So that where you find that in hill country is usually high up in that upper 1/3 of the mountain. You know, especially when they get hunting pressure. Right now, those beds that I found were down just over the edge there. It's probably not pure 1/3, but just down off the top of it. So, but it really depends on the deer and it depends on the time. Right now, early season, no hunting pressure. They don't need a bed up super high, but during the season, they'll probably be up there on the top of the mountain. Yeah. We've seen that year over year where right before, you know, in the key times are coming down off the top.
Yeah. Like up behind camp, that was a pretty big thing. You knew right around the 11th hour, we call it, you know, right before dark, they come right down off that mountain, off the top, you know, that it was like a given. You knew they were coming, you know?
Yep. That's right out of their bedding. It's pretty obvious. If you're on the right trail,
Yeah.
You know, if you weren't, then you didn't see them. So, but yeah, that's money. So you want to go into the next question?
Yeah, it says, do you think it's important to hunt near buck bedding?
I don't think it's necessarily important. I think it helps. Specifically, you know, a lot of people complain that you get in that October lull where you don't see any deer and feel like they're not moving at all. Yeah. I watched a Mississippi State deer study thing where they said that the deer still move, but they're moving in a very contained area, their core area.
Yeah.
And, you know, not their home range. I'm not talking about their home range. I'm talking about the core area around their bedding that they stay in. They'll get up, they'll feed, they'll move around. It can be just like 200 yards, but they're up on their feet multiple times during the day,
yeah.
You know, but they stay in that area. So if you're not close to buck bedding,
yeah,
you're not going to see them, you know, but I think it's important. Those travel routes, a lot of these buck ain't getting out of their bed, especially the older ones, you know, until it's really getting ready to get dark. I mean, how many times have we been out there hunting on these mountains and you're coming down out of the tree and the deer's there in the dark?
I mean, I feel like they're more nocturnal, you know, in the early season. See, this kind of feeds into my theory a little bit, where I think it would be wise to hunt closer to buck bedding in the early parts of the season when they're still kind of in their natural cycle. Soon as that they kind of, you know, develop and go into rut, it's almost pointless because they're on the move.
During the rut.
What's the point of hunting a buck bed in the middle of a rut? They are traveling for doe. So it's, you know what I mean? It's that's how
I
see it.
I think you get to the end of October and you switch, you switch up. I mean, the area we hunt, I think that end of that first week of November has been money here recently.
Yeah.
For the rut. So and you want to be on those rut funnels.
Yeah.
Go after that.
All right, man. So, you know, the next question here is what does hunting the wind mean and how do you plan for it? So real quick, I want to just throw this out there. You know, we have names for hunting spots. I have a theory. My new theory is to name the hunting spots in their geographic location. Meaning, I know this might sound stupid. Like the new spot I found, South Bend is the name of the spot, because now I know it's on the south side of the mountain. It's on a bend. So when I wake up and look, or the night before we're looking at wind, what it's going to be like, nope, that's not the spot I need to go. I need to be on the north side because, you know what? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a technique.
Yeah. I mean, it's for me because we have all these spots and you're not thinking about where it is in direction, so to speak. So to be able to play the wind better, if you name that spot with its geographic location, then you're better.
That's funny.
Sorry, my arm hurts from crabbing, pulling all them traps.
I'm doing my wins like that. Is that a mess or what? Just a few spots in there. Just a few spots in there.
Boy, you're hitting it heavy in that area.
Yeah, of course, if you zoom in, they're not quite as bad.
No, I was going to say, did you scout all the same area just 30 feet away from each other?
No, that's a lot farther away. Farther away. But the great thing about the app is that you can just put in the wind that you want for the spot when you're scouting it, so you're not forgetting about it. And then when it comes time to hunt it, the offline map feature, you don't need coverage with your phone, and you can look at it and say, oh, that wind is wrong for that spot today. And a lot of times we know that anyway, because most of the time our predominant winds are from the west or northwest.
Yeah.
So we know that. And when you get an east wind, it changes things up, you know, a lot.
Yeah.
And the deer will change their bedding on the wind. So, but what's the question again? How to hunt the wind?
What does hunting the wind mean and how do you plan for it?
Well, hunting the wind is just another part of your scent control program. Right.
Yes.
So you always want to hunt with the wind in your face and, you know, blowing over your shoulders, this, you know, towards you. And you want your primary spot for that deer to be directly out in front of you. For me, it's 20 yards is where I'd like to be, but trees don't always cooperate with that. And you want that wind, but going in, when you're trying to access the spot too, you need to plan for that wind, because you don't want to blow your scent all into your spot while you're traveling, or even across the trails that you think the deer might be traveling, which can be quite tricky, you know? So you might have to cut the trail at some point, because in these mountains, you know, we're just a big valley here where we're hunting, and 26 miles of valley, but it's still a valley, you know? So they're going to have the same kind of wind structure all the time, east or west, but we also get the thermals you have to take into account for. And the thermals is just as the air heats in the morning, it drives those thermal winds up the mountain, sometimes pushing stuff up way high, you know? Yeah. And then other times, you know, they could just drop like a brick too. As the day goes on, you get closer to night, the air cools and they drop. And so you have to factor for that.
I mean, there's a key.
And then how the winds come together. Now you have swirling winds, which is why I also try to do personal scent, body scent control and clothing scent control as much as possible. It's not going to stop it. You're still going to smell. I just try to minimize my signature.
So I think there's a key factor that we're not covering here is also when you pattern the deer. So you're going into a spot in the morning or the evening, knowing which way they're coming from. So by playing the wind, you're going to be downwind of them where they're walking in, they're walking with the wind away from your scent, so to speak. Did I explain that right?
No, but it.
No, but you know what I mean. You don't want the wind at your back blowing right into the way that they're walking.
Yeah. So you don't want that. Yeah.
No. You have to. So let's say, you know, that the wind's blowing this way and the deer come from that way. That's kind of the perfect setup. So you have to be set up down from that. Yeah.
Exactly. That's why for years when I was not using the wind at all, I was hunting that spot down from camp, and I wouldn't see anything. And it's probably because the wind was blowing right down through the valley there, and I was just burning it out and didn't even know it. Yeah. So I was clueless to the whole wind thing.
Right.
But
I've really woken up to the whole wind thing a lot in the last two seasons. It's like, I don't know. I needed to really get into it more. And the last few seasons, and success has done that for me, you know, being
successful. You have to trust it. It's hard to trust it if you say, I can just wear scent control clothes and I won't get busted. And it's not true.
That's only part of it. You know,
it'll minimize it. You can minimize your signature. And we've had deer right under us with a bad wind, you know, and just walking around and not smell you or not pay attention to you for whatever reason. Yeah. And, you know, be in the middle of the season, but at the same time had deer, you know, that I killed that one buck there at the end of the year, 2 years ago. In the rut, and I had a doe come into me, and there's no way she could have seen me. It was so thick. I didn't move. And all of a sudden she blew and ran out of there. And I think she caught my wind.
Yeah.
That was the only thing I could think of. But yet the buck chasing doe, they didn't care at all. They didn't care at all because they were focused on one thing. But.
Sorry, I just hear something running in the background. I think it's you.
It is me.
Oh, well. So I think there's another question here. What features do you look for when picking your stand location? So for me, I don't really get too wound up about the early season, and you know that. So I don't get too strategic, you know, in the early part of the year. So for me, I like rut. I call it a rutcation, you know, and that's where I take most of my vacation time. So, I mean, we want to talk about strategy there. I'm looking for a place that I know doe are coming through, because when you see doe in rut, what does that mean? That buck are going to be following, hopefully, you know. So that all depends on if the doe's hot or not, blah, blah, blah. But for me, I'm hunting off the ground, so I'm looking at a good ambush spot. Well, you've heard us talk about this ambush, you know, ambush spots for me hunting off the ground. But yeah, I'm strategically gearing more towards rut, and I'm trying to find the cattle paths, you know, pretty much. So what about you?
Well, first off, the wind. You want, you know, if there's a trail that you're looking at that they're coming through, most more times than not, you got to be hunting over some kind of travel route that you expect them to come
through. Yeah, I mean.
So whatever spot that you find, you know, like for bedding, I'm trying to stay away from there at least 100 yards, maybe a little more. But it's also, then you back off from there. It's finding that, like you said, that ambush point where you got available cover, that you got something behind you, so it's not, you're not silhouetted up in the tree, because I'm up in the tree, you're on the ground.
Right.
You know, so you don't have to worry about that as much. But so I'm looking at my silhouette. I want to make sure that I can be high enough in a tree that I'm not also standing out because I'm up too high or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for that perfect height. But I want to be 20 yards, 15, 20 yards from that trail to maximize my shot opportunities. Cause I'm not going to, my personal limit is 30 yards. I won't shoot at a deer past 30 yards.
Right.
Unless it's real big and I'm going crazy about it. Those rules can be broken, Dan. Those rules can be broken.
Yeah, you're going to break ethics. We all have that in us. I mean, it's for a lot of times, like where
we depend on the size of the rest.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, you know, in the Pennsylvania forest, you're not seeing, we're not seeing the monsters.
You're not seeing Pope and Young deer.
Right. So when you do see them, you kind of do crazy things. Yeah. It's like a guy that's horny, you know?
That's the one thing we haven't talked about. I mean, the area we're hunting, we're not, these mountain deer, if you get something that's at 8 point and a deer's got, you know, I mean, you hit 4 years old on a buck. That one I had, the taxidermist aged it and he said he was 4 years old.
Yeah.
It's doing something for our area because it's so tough to find a big buck in that area. And even the biggest ones that we've gotten are not, definitely not big to, you know, Iowa, Kansas standards.
Right.
Or even Western Pennsylvania, Western PA, it got some monsters. So,
I mean, our area's hunted pretty good too. And I mean, and also there's so much territory. We're literally hunting a needle in a haystack. You know, and to even see a buck, sometimes you're grateful for that. You know what I mean?
So much territory to walk.
Yes. Grow. It's literally very vast, you know?
Yeah. It's very tough. I don't think people appreciate how tough it is. And we've been pretty successful. So
yeah, we're doing something right.
The other thing I wanted to say about picking your spot is, and you said it the other day in that other podcast, you know, your ambush points, your pinch points, try to look for those funnels that they're kind of constricted in their movement. And sometimes I've hunted some really thick stuff just because, and I have a little tiny shot window that I'm going to have to try to get them to stop to get that shot, or you're not going to get them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got burned on that a couple times, but it's, you know, sometimes it's the best way to be successful, but also can be real tough to hunt.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, generally in our area, it's tough to hunt, you know, it's
very,
but you know what? All it's going to do is make us better hunters in the long run, you know, to have that challenge and be successful. I mean, it does it kind of boost your ego a little bit, but you know what? There's nothing wrong with that because it adds confidence and it keeps you interested and you keep hunting, you know?
I think that when we go other places, like go to Ohio, go down to Maryland, hunt, that when we hunt those other places, it's, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying that it's a different type of territory and it's not as vast as what we're hunting and a little bit more condensed. And I think it allows us to get on deer a little quicker.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Well, I mean, just a quick little story is me and you went down to Texas and we did the, we'll call it a high fence hunt, you know, where there was some just absolute rock stars down there.
Through a veterans group.
Through a veterans group, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we had a hell of an opportunity to go down there. We went down there. So I'm up in a box blind and I'm talking to the guide, which this guy, he was great because I ask a lot of questions. I'm naturally very inquisitive. So I'm asking him a bunch of questions. The next thing you know, he kind of says to me, he's like, so how do you guys hunt? And I pretty much told him about the slides. And I was like, yeah, we pretty much, you'll find a little tiny deer trail and you're going to climb a tree. There could be a week that goes by, you don't even see a deer. And I was like, but you know, we hunt out of trees and, you know, on these tiny little deer paths. And he's like sitting there, he's like, wow. So you guys kind of hunt like Native American Indians. And I just started laughing and it hit me. I'm like, you know what? I never thought of it that way, but we're hunting the hard way up there. You know, I mean, these guys, they're hunting by feeders, which we can't do in Pennsylvania. They're, you know, it's like cattle coming into a feed trough down there. And it's not hunting to me. Me and you have experienced the challenge of real whitetail hunting in Pennsylvania. And it's hard to go back and do. I mean, yeah, it's nice to come home with a real monster buck like we both did, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? The reward is in them little 7 points, them little eight points we get here in Pennsylvania, because you earned it. I mean, you worked your tail off to get them things.
Oh, yeah. And we go nuts when it happens.
And we absolutely do. Rightfully so, man. You know, it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, that Texas trip was great. Those people down there were fantastic.
Absolutely.
It's something I'll remember, you know, for the rest of my life. Yeah. Like you said, you know, when somebody's telling you which one of the bucks you can shoot, that's not hunting to me, you know. So I had a great time and I appreciated everything they did for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to stick with the way we hunt.
Yeah.
Although, you know, maybe, you know, hunting on somebody's land this season might be in the cards. So
yeah.
Be more than happy to do a little bit of private land.
Yeah. And so speaking of that, so in the next few podcasts here, we'd like to get a good friend of mine. He's probably one of my best friends in life. And you, Mike, have gotten to know him, and he wants us to come out and go hunt on his land. He wants to come to our place and hunt on ours. And he has in the past. So, Andy Musser, you know, we'd like to have you come on. We'd like you to tell us a little bit about your story. And you have a pretty, pretty powerful story to tell. And we'll let that up to you and go from there. But we'd love to have you on. Love you, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, he's a heck of a man.
Yeah.
And I'd be more than happy to go down and harvest an animal on his land and take advantage of him.
Yeah, I mean, even if his land ain't hot, he has a lot of game lands around him that doesn't get hit very hard because it's a CWD area, which pushed a lot of hunters out. But it's, you know, just that opportunity to go hunt with somebody else, somebody that we care about, and we have a great time with. I have a great time with Andy. Went out to his property this year for Spring Gobbler the second weekend. And he was like, hey man, can you do the calling and stuff? I never really hunted a whole lot of turkey. And he's gotten one with a bow, but you know, in Spring Gobbler, he's like, I kind of want to see how it happens. You know, the calling, the cadence of it. And I was like, yeah. So we get up there, we sit down and we were kind of back to back at this fallen tree. I start calling, no sooner I start calling, boom, it scared the bejesus out of me. A little pee came out. I was like, hang on, damn it. I'm telling you, I look over at him, his eyes, dude, I'm telling you, his eyes were this big. They're like saucers. He looked at me and he goes, coyote, coyote. And after the dust settled, he's like, man, do you believe that just happened? Like, you know, and I'm like, yeah, because you're with me. I'm like kind of a coyote magnet, but them birds, they come into them coyote call, or them coyotes come into the bird call sometimes. And that just told me that I was doing the calling right, you know. But yeah, man, Andy's a great guy. I love hunting with him. Had him up at camp a couple years back, and it would be neat to start a tradition with him. He's a hell of a good man. So
yeah, we had a good time the last time he hunted with us. You know?
Yeah.
Sometimes the more people we have at camp, the better. It's just, you know, and then when somebody gets one,
yeah,
it's such a good time. Yeah, if you haven't experienced that, you know, I don't care if it's a hunting club or whatever, man, just hunting by yourself is, you know, I like when I go out to be isolated, I don't want anybody near me.
Yeah.
I want to be in complete isolation. I get ticked off when any hunters come near me almost stupidly.
Yeah. But like, it's public land.
Hey, stay out of my area. It's my area.
No, but yeah.
But anyway, so no, yeah. So
But like that.
But back at campus, coming back and telling those stories and coming in and having your old man say, "Hey, I really had to go to the bathroom bad, but this big doe came along, and
so I had to pinch it off real quick, and I shot the doe. Now I came back to camp real quick to go to the bathroom. Now I got to go drag her back out." But you want to talk about that camaraderie, you know, there is something special about that camaraderie, the stories, and our old man is a world-class storyteller. And
we get him on the podcast.
None of it's a lie. The guy doesn't lie. So everything comes out of his mouth is truthful. It's just crazy, the stuff that happens to him. But on that note, you know, you talk about that sense of community. So a couple of years, well, not a couple, 20, 30 years ago, whatever it was, you know, Dad used to hunt with all our cousins and they were archery hunting, da, 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 went in town for the evening to the local bar and they wanted to get a couple drinks. So they were in there drinking, blah, blah, blah. Well, all their bows were in the bed of a truck.
Oh yeah.
So they get out of the bar. All the bows were stolen except for one. And that specific cousin, they are heading across the bridge, the Susquehanna River. They're heading across it. And he says, "You know what? If none of you guys can hunt the rest of the weekend, I'm not hunting either. Stop the truck." They get out. He gets out, grabs the bow, throws the bow off into the river, looks over. There's a guy walking up the bridge. And he's like, "What is he doing? We're just throwing." Like,
Every time I hear that story, I'm like, no way. I'm not throwing my bow.
I'm not hunting either. He throws his bow into the river.
With how much time I had to put into getting those broadhead zeroed and stuff, or, you know, shot
in. I don't think they're spending money, the amount of money that we're spending on bows today back then. But that is still one of the funniest stories ever.
Yeah.
He throws his bow right in the drink. How much you want to bet that guy walking on the bridge that next morning was down in that river looking for it?
No, that's back in the day when they would say, "Oh, that's a 2-beer trip, and that's a 6-beer trip." Things you can't do now. So.
No.
Hey, I was thinking of something. I know we kind of talked about before we end the podcast. We talked about hunting the wind, and I was looking at the questions to make sure we covered everything.
Right.
And the one part of that question was, how do you plan for it?
Okay.
And the one thing I wanted to say is the plan for it is, one, first go to that spot, scout the spot exactly where you're going to hunt the tree, mark it, GPS it, whatever, but then know exactly what wind works for that spot based on where you're at. Take a compass with you. Look at it or use your app, because the apps don't always show you perfect orientation. From where your tree is, you know, get a good direction. But then when you're back and you're preparing for the season, you know, look at your forecast. And the forecast, as we know up in the mountains, doesn't always work. And our old man put a windsock up at camp.
Yeah.
So that you can actually see the wind direction when you get up. And then of course we use to help us determine the wind direction too.
Yeah, so, thanks to the hunting public for learning us on that, you know.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Yeah, that's helped me tremendously.
Yeah.
It's been able to, you know, because even if you know the wind direction, you get out you're on your way to the spot, you know, and you say, "Man, that wind feels kind of weird," and throw some milkweed out halfway there, 3/4 of the way there, and you might say, "This is not going to work. I got to back out. And it's because you don't want to hunt it just to hunt it, as we say. Don't force a hunt. That's going to be the toughest thing for me to continue to do, because sometimes I'm so enamored with the spot that I just want to hunt it. And I gotta have that self-control to make sure I don't screw it up and blow the area out.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Yeah. So a little add on at the end there.
Yeah. So, hey, I mean, if we're going to wrap this thing up, you know, first off, I want to thank everybody for listening, you know, hit that like button, follow, you know, if you're on Spotify, you know, get on us and check, you know, whatever you call that on Spotify. But
click the follow button.
Yeah, subscribe, man. If anybody has any questions, please submit them, because we're more than willing to answer them. And, you know, Mike, this is your kind of show. I'm sure a lot of people have questions, and, you know, this today, this podcast should show that, you know, you're going to answer them. You're going to, you know, give people what they want.
Hey, we don't know everything. That's why it's called the Everyday Bowhunter. You know, we're just a couple of guys like to hunt.
Yeah.
And just slowly but surely getting a little bit more serious about everything we do to try to become better hunters.
Right.
And that's what this is about. We just want to become better hunters. So,
yeah.
Hey, join the ride. We're going to screw up this season. We're going to have success this season. And, well, hopefully we're going to have success this season.
Yep.
One of us. And hopefully.
Yeah.
And then, you know, join us in that journey. And it's going to be fun.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a neat, you know, future podcast during the season. You know, that's going to be the best part. But
yeah, I'd really like to set it up at the table in camp and get everybody on.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
A lot more to come, everybody. Again, subscribe, hit that like button. Thank you so much. Submit questions. We're going to answer them. Thanks.